a shot in the dark. Where is sort of spark? I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so here we go, kids. Episode 210. I'm surprised that I ended up doing this online radio show at all. And I'm certainly surprised that I've done 210 of anything that takes over an hour to do on an almost daily basis. Well, okay, a few times a week basis, let's be honest. But yeah, if you'd have told me, you know, several years ago, hey, you're going to start this thing and every day you're going to like think about stuff and you're going to sit down and you're going to record something and you're going to do this. I'm like, that's a great idea. I would love to do something like that, but I know me, there's just no way I'm going to do that. You know? Yeah. So speaking of, surprising things in this world, today is, at least, so Facebook tells me, I don't know if this is in fact the case. It doesn't matter really if it's the case. But supposedly Facebook says today is the birthday of Michael Miley, my friend, co-listener, fellow listener to The Counter Position, and one of the most all-around interesting, strange, beautiful, magnificent human beings I know, drummer for the band Rival Sons, and one of the more interesting people slash things to happen in my life at some time. My friend, Michael Miley. Michael, I celebrate your existence. A big, fat birthday shout out to Michael Miley. You know, it's interesting. You know, you start this kind of thing, and there's been a bunch of interesting things happen from this show. People I've gotten back in touch with, like Allie Cavanaugh. Old friend of mine from way back in the day, who's now like this world-class painter, came out on the woodwork and is a big fan of the show. And we've reconnected and, had a lot of online conversation and talked on the phone. It's just a great human being that I love. But who'd have thought that, you know, some rock star guy who has been on the end of he's on the Catholic end of a long search for reality and is just so serious and so deeply committed to studying and to thinking and to reading and to becoming a better human being and serving God, but at the same time, you know, being an individual and being interesting in this world, that some guy like that would come around and through friends would end up being friends with me through some radio show online. It just makes me realize that you just never know what God is doing. You never know who you're praying for. You know, you never know who God is preparing whenever you do pray. You know, for instance, I'll let you guys in on something that's kind of personal for me. A long time ago, Father Philip Chavez, back when he was Father Philip Chavez, was one of my mentors, and I listened to one of his tapes, and he said that you should always, on your rosary, you should just make a default kind of dedication to each decade, and that way, if you don't have a particular intention to add to a decade, you just tell God, hey, if I don't say anything this second decade, no matter what set of mysteries I'm praying for, or this first decade or this third decade, is always for this. So I have a very particular intention for my first decade on my rosary that I won't talk about online. My second decade for years has been, there's an aspect of what my second decade for is for my wife or for my spouse, whoever or whatever she may be. And that's something I adopted whenever I started my big vocation kind of discernment And, you know, at the same time, I've gone back and forth between, you know, trying to figure out what I'm called to in my past, and, you know, whether I'm called to marry or not, and who she is, and trying, you know, and trying to find her, or to at the same time discern what it is that I am to give my life for. Maybe her is the church. You know, at one point I was pretty convinced I was called to the priesthood. Now, I don't know, I'm kind of, I'm back and forth between a woman entering the game late in my life, and that being the thing that I'm called to, or Calyx and the apostolate that I'm building being the thing that I have to give everything to. But the point being is that every time I pray my rosary, when I get to that second decade, part of my intention is, and for my spouse, whoever or whatever she may be. Now, that means that if there is a woman somewhere that I am called to marry, that I'm going to meet, for all I know, when I started praying that rosary, she could have been, you know, deep in some horrible relationship, maybe not even a Catholic, or you know, going through something, or, you know, who knows? But I don't know. I'm praying for that particular person, and I'll find out later who it is. So that maybe given my penchant with Calyx, maybe in my penchant for reaching the unchurched and the people who are seeking, who are kind of not in the typical Catholic bubble, so to speak, maybe all of my prayer for those people and for the person seeking, the person trying, maybe some of that prayer through the mystery of the community of the church, and how God, and the mystery of prayer itself, let's be honest, no, who knows? I still am not really absolutely comfortable with any understanding about petitionary prayer and how that affects God or doesn't affect God or reality. But some of that prayer could have been applied to someone like a guy like Miley. So who'd have thought that, you know, something that I'm praying for at some point could somehow affect someone else's life, and then that person, through some weird set of circumstances, could come into my life. Maybe my prayer didn't affect him in any way. But you know, all I'm saying is that a guy like I'm using Miley and his birthday is an excuse to talk about this. You never know who you're praying for. You know, I didn't sit down and pray for you know, some dude that, you know, is a rock star, plays drums in some band, to come around and be my friend. But I wouldn't have even thought that was something that was possible. But then a new friend shows up, and that's the thing, is that I think, let's shift focus here a little bit. I'm kind of riffing this morning here. So, it seems like God can do a lot of really, really interesting things, but the most interesting things that God does is bringing people into our lives and bringing change into people's lives. So, and then, you know, maybe through us, or then bringing them to us, you know, people are the most interesting thing that God made, and they're the most interesting thing that can happen to us. And so, chances are, anytime you're praying, you're probably praying either for a person, you're praying for something to happen to a person, or for a person to come into your sphere of influence, or for a person to come in and influence you. You're praying for relationship. Now, ultimately, we're praying for personal relationship in the sense that we're praying for relationship with God. But there is a thing, is that in the Catholic world, especially, we're kind of like, we're wary of this phrase, a personal relationship with Jesus Christ or a personal relationship with God. And you'll hear Protestants, evangelicals and whatnot asking Catholics that, and they don't know how to handle that. And they say, no, I don't have a personal relationship with God. In fact, at one point the Pope said that it was dangerous to have a personal relationship with God. And you'll see that on YouTube, like some evangelicals and anti-Catholics throwing that up. And they ignore all the language about, you know, encountering Christ and having a personal encounter with Christ. The difference is that, do you mean the word personal in the sense of private? Or do you mean personal in the sense of the kind of relationship that you have with persons? So ultimately, you're praying to have a relationship with God that is a relationship between persons, to love them and to receive love from them, to be taken up into this community, this of the Trinity, and to be in this personal, this relationship of persons with God. Because God is one God, but he's a community of persons, a communio personarum, if you want to get all Latin about it. And so, so that's just kind of what's banging around my head on this topic, is that the way God often answers our prayers is by bringing us into relationship. And I look out across my world and about what has changed my life for the good and for the worse at times, and it's always been relationship. So if you're praying, if you're praying for something, look up for an answer, and chances are that answer has a face, because that's the way God usually works. Anyway, there's a unplanned riff on the personal and relationship to prayer, and happy birthday to Michael Biley. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See, only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. So, picking up the thread from the first segment, speaking of praying for things that you don't know or you don't understand, I saw a great little video of Eric Clapton from some time ago playing a song he wrote with Pavarotti and with a big orchestra and a big gospel choir and all this stuff, and it's a song called Holy Mother. And the story behind it, I guess, is that Clapton was in rehab and he had hit absolute rock bottom, and he said this phrase. He said that he got to this place and he went to his knees and he began to pray, to talk to he knew not who. He didn't know who he was talking to. He didn't know who he was praying to. He didn't know what he believed. He didn't know. He just knew that he needed help, and that the need in his heart and his longing inside him, you know, had an object. That, my friends, is in fact what Monsignor Giuzzani talks about when he calls that with the religious sense. That, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about this is an argument for the existence of God. He says that, you know, we get hungry. We have a faculty within us that has hunger, and that hunger has an object. It's called food. We get thirsty. It can become maddening, right? We have this deep, deep longing for something that we call thirst. Why? Because there's such a thing as water. We have a deep craving. We get we get turned on or whatever, you know, we long for, we get this sexual longing. We get you know, that feeling with us. Why? Because there's such a thing as sex. There's such a thing as that interface with another human person. Now, ultimately, there's a whole nother, you know, topic to talk about with, you know, the role that gender plays and all that, and whether it's a longing for something that you don't have, that you're incomplete without. But that, let's not get that rabbit trail today. But there's a longing, right? Sorry, I'm making mic noise because my ear itches. So I itch because, you know, but like all of those things, people and as individual persons, we have this deep longing for meaning, for something non-contingent, for something that answers to this void in us that is crying out, right? We have this longing. So why in the world would it be surprising that there's an object to that longing? Now, I think there's two reactions to that longing. Either you can suppress it, or you can say, "Oh, I have this longing, and therefore, and it seems like lots of people have this longing, and so I'm not going to explain it away. I'm going to say, if we all have this longing, we don't seem to be the kind of beings that have longings that don't have objects, right? And so there must be an object, you know. People get lonely. Why do we get lonely? Because there's other people." Right? There's, if there was no such thing, you know, I've repeated this before, but Jazani uses this example, and I'm paraphrasing it and adding to it, but this is the kind of thing that Jazani would say is a good example of this, is that, let's say that you had somehow, you had a little boy, right? A little small boy, a toddler, barely. And there's a shipwreck and he washes up on shore, and for whatever just luck, the climate is temperate. There's no major diseases in the water or anything. There's no predators on this little island or anything that's too nasty that will bite you and sting you or whatever. And there just is an abundance of food that looks pretty, you know, would draw the eye, you know, that he would recognize early on, like fruit or something. And over time, this little guy survives, and over, you know, he eats fruit, you know, and he figures it out or whatever, you know, maybe figures out how to get shellfish or something. Anyway, however, the little dude survives, but he can't really remember anything before the island. I mean, he was barely two, maybe, you know, when he came to the island. So he's been there for, let's say, 10 years, 10, 11 years, right? And he's been on this island. He's observed, you know, birds and fish and fruit and little things running around the island or whatever, you know. And then, long about 12, 13 years old, a hunger awakens in him. Something for which he doesn't know what, but it's something. It's real. It's a deep, deep longing for something. Now, if he had anyone around him that could question him, they would say, "Well, what do you mean there's this? What do you mean you have a longing for something? You don't even know if it's there. You don't even know what it is." And he'd say, "Well, I know that there's something there because I'm longing for it." Well, what is it? Are you hungry? No, it's not like that. It's kind of like that, but it's not that. Are you thirsty? Well, it's kind of like that, but it's not that. Well, what is it? I don't know. I'm right about the time that I hit X amount of years on this island. I got to a certain size. I started noticing that I was starting to get bigger and stronger at a little more rapid pace. These little tufts of stuff started kind of coming out on my, under my arms, and I just down in my soul, even in my body, I I've started having this longing for something, and I don't know what it is. Now, people would think he's crazy, but we know that what he's experiencing is a longing for something that exists, but that he's never experienced, that he doesn't know it exists, but it's an absolutely normal movement within the faculties and existence of a human person to long for that at that moment. Now, I would contend, Jazani would contend, and I think Eric Clapton would contend, my friend Michael Miley would contend, all of us who are on the same page on this would contend, that it makes no more sense to have a deep longing for something that you don't know what it is. But in this, notice that everyone seems to have this longing, and not say, well, I wonder what that is. I wonder what the object of this thing is. And it's funny because, you know, when in good little Darwinists, we would say that, you know, these things don't exist for no reason. I was listening to a TED talk talking about lying. So a TED radio hour that just happened over the weekend. There was the guy from Skeptic magazine, and he was talking about how you can wire people up. Two things he was talking about. There was talking about you can wire people up and you can stimulate a certain part of their brain and they will have the feeling of a presence. And that this happens in nature sometimes. And, you know, we have call it mystical experience or the paranormal or whatever, you know. And before that, he was saying how we're programmed to believe. And the reason we're programmed to believe is that if you were a hunter-gatherer and you're out there on the savannah and you hear a rustling in the bush and you're the kind of savannah hunter that goes, it's probably nothing, you didn't pass your genes on. So all of us that survived are the ones that go, let's just err on the side of that being a lion. And so anytime you see phenomena, you assume that there is something underneath it. And so we're pattern connectors, we're pattern seers by nature, right? Now he says that, well, then that just explains it. That's why, you know, we see this and this, we see it, we connect a pattern and we assume that there is some kind of pattern maker, or, you know, that there's some kind of meaning underneath this because we're meaning finders by natural selection. And because of that, we have evolved, a brain that when we have this certain experience, we'll even connect it to the feeling of a presence or something. But it's no different than us experiencing the sound and the brushes, and we just assume it must be a line. That's interesting. Now, when we get back, I want to look at that just a little bit. And I want to look at two ways that we could interpret that same information and where the presuppositions come from in the way that we would kind of interpret the different ways that we could see that phenomena. You know, there's the Darwinist side, the materialist side seems to think that if they can show you where this is and show you how it comes about, that explains it. And then the other side doesn't. I want to explore that a little bit. And I think that we might be able to get an insight into a few other things in this world from that. So let's go to the break. You're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll see you on the other side.
Lynn, how we crave a hanging. And it's dark.
Breadbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Breadbox Media.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so in the last segment, in case you just came back, you know, it's kind of a very typical Counterposition segment with too many influences in one segment. So we started talking about Eric Clapton and a moment that he had in rehab, where he was, you know, he hit the, you know, the classic addiction thing where he hit rock bottom. He said something. He said he started praying, and he didn't know who to or what, but he was praying, and he knew he was praying, and he knew that there was something that, you know, he didn't have an object or a person he was praying to, but he knew he was praying to someone, right? And we talked about how C.S. Lewis talked about faculties and ends, and how the reason we can get hungry and thirsty, the reason we can desire sex and have those feelings within ourselves and all this, or because those objects exist. There's such thing as water. There's such thing as food, right? And that's why we have hunger pains and pains of thirst, you know? And then I talked about a story that Jazani tells, kind of a little parable, about a boy that is washed up on a desert island when he's like a toddler or something. And he managed to survive, and he hits puberty around 12, 13 years old, and he starts feeling just within himself, both his emotional part, his body, his soul, every part of him has this longing for something. He's longing deeply with his entire being, and he doesn't know what it's for, but he knows that it must be because he's longing for it. And if anyone would question him and say, hey, how do you know this thing exists? And he could say, well, because I'm longing for it, right? And just like I said before, Jazani compares that to the religious sense. It's that same thing that Lewis was talking about, how every culture on earth has this longing for the infinite. You know, I remember Lorenzo Albacete has such a great treatment of this in that book, God at the Ritz, where he says that it doesn't matter how far back they go, they find a new cave. The older the cave, they still find it. There's this bull on the wall. They're all in the sociologist telling this is some kind of a religious thing. It's like you can't go back. You can't find a time when man was man, when he was human, and he didn't long for the infinite, right? Why? Because the infinite is, right? And then finally, we were talking about these two TED Talks, this guy from Skeptic Magazine, the editor of Skeptic Magazine, was saying that we're programmed to believe just because basically the people who were over safe and cautious by reacting to every rustle in the bushes and assuming it was a lion and connecting patterns to reality were the people who survived. And so, and it kind of shows that we've got this part of our brain. When you stimulate this part of your brain, you feel like there's a presence there. So where I want to pick this up at is I want to look at these two ways of looking at things and what they kind of portray. What kind of presuppositions are kind of behind these two ways of looking at things? So in the West, you know, from kind of Aristotle on, through, and you know, it became hugely part of the West and part of the even the scientific tradition through kind of the influence of the scholastic world and St. Thomas Aquinas and his embracing of Aristotle is kind of, how to say it, a belief in the fundamental goodness of our perception and our sense and its ability to tell us about the world. And that we are built to understand and see reality. And if we have a pattern-recognizing tradition or a pattern-recognizing faculty within us, it's not because we're the lineage of easily duped cavemen who never got eaten because they were too safe, but because there are patterns. We have a pattern recognition faculty because there are patterns. And that you can, just because you can hack the part of your brain that allows you to kind of feel a presence, we would say, look, there's a part of our brain that allows you to feel a presence, right? That must be there for a reason. The fact that you can hack it doesn't mean that that's merely is what it is. Now, the presupposition that kind of hides underneath all this is going back to Aristotle. Aristotle had four causes, right? He has the formal cause, the final cause, the efficient cause, and the material cause. So a man named Francis Bacon, that you've heard me gripe about on occasion, the only Bacon I don't like, wrote what is the name of the book? The New Organon? Is that his book? Yes, The New Organon. And, see, I had a false dichotomy going in my head, had to type real fast and look it up. I was trying to think if it was The New Organon or if it was The Great Inspiration. Turns out he wrote both of those books. So, he basically, he looked at these two causes within Aristotle, the formal cause and the final cause. The formal cause is the thing, is what it is. The thing that makes it what it is. The what it isness of the thing. The form is, what is that? What is it Aristotle calls that? The principle of motion and rest and hearing in a thing, right? But then the final cause is its end, its purpose, its telos. Right? That for the sake of which, right? Well, he thinks those are just, occult causes, he calls them, if I remember right. They're just BS. They're added on. They don't mean anything. So what do you have left? You have the material cause and the efficient cause, or the agent cause. Basically, you have, what is it made of? How is it put together? And how did it get that way? That's it. So Socrates, you know, would ask the chief philosophical question, what is it, right? And if you ask Bacon or any decent modern post-Baconian scientist, you know, what is it? You point at a dog, you say, what is it? He's going to give you a recipe, right? He's going to give you a list of parts, you know, lemon juice, sugar, ice, water, and he's going to give you the way these things go together, X amount of carbon, X amount of protein here, these kind of things. It's a very complex recipe. A dog is a complex recipe. It's a very complex set of parts and a complex punch list on how the parts go together. That's it. And you can only really know him if you can reproduce him in the lab, you know? And so, cause I mean, he ironically kind of still agrees with Aristotle in the sense that you got to know something from the causes. So you got to know what these parts are and how they go together. So, which means you have to be able to make it, which puts you in the place of God, just for the record. Sidebar. If you want to understand, I know I go on and on about Bacon every once in a while. If you want to understand how important Francis Bacon and this change and how this makes us view the world, how important this is, go buy a copy of Theology of the Body, A Man and Woman, He Created Them, A Theology of the Body, translated by Michael Wallstein. Wallstein, his introduction to that book is,
I mean, probably one of the best introductions to Wojtyla's thought out there. It's worth the whatever the book costs at $30, $29, something like that. That little 130-page introduction is worth the book in itself. Not to mention a great translation of Theology of the Body and all of the chapter headings that came from the original Polish notes that make it way more accessible. There's a commercial, you know, available at better Catholic bookstores near you and giant pagan booksellers online. But the difference between these two. So if we have the feeling of a presence or the recognition of meaning and pattern is just structure for someone like this guy from with this TED talk, right, from the Skeptic magazine, it's just structure because everything is structure because there is nothing other than matter. There's nothing but matter and energy. There's nothing but atoms in the space in between them. That's all there is. It's all geometry, right? That's everything is just geometry. The difference between feeding a hungry child and eating a hungry child is a matter of it's a geometry of particles in a three-dimensional space. That's all it is. There's no anything that is not language about that three-dimensional geometry of where these particles are is revealed religion and might as well be the spaghetti monster behind the sun that sends you the invisible marshmallows. That is the modern world we live in. But just maybe, friends, maybe we have a pattern recognition faculty because there are patterns. And maybe we long for the infinite because there is the infinite, right? And so if that's the case, if you look at your longing for the infinite, if you look at your longing for the divine the same way you look at your longing for food, water, sex, etc., and more along the lines of like you're longing for patterns, you're longing for meaning, and you act on it, then you're acting quite rationally. You're acting super duper rationally. You're acting as if you can know reality because it seems like you know reality and it doesn't seem like you have a bunch of faculties that don't have any ends. So there you go. So act on your desire for the infinite because there is an infinite and it's there. I love to know how many times I've did the bacon rant on this show. Our bacon rant over. All right, let's go to the break. When we get back, I'm going to rant about something else. You're listening to The Counter Position.
Then all the color glass that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to see. Love bedecked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dumb.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. And we are in the final lap, the final loop, the final segment. The shot putting fat boy has been forced to run the open mile, and he is in that last lap, hating his coach there. It's such an inside joke. I tell you, one of these days, I am going to get one of the coaches from my high school on here, and I am going to challenge them in public for making me run the open mile in front of girls in other schools. All right, so hey, I was talking about Theology of the Body, which made me talk about Michael Wallstein. And hey, speaking of Wallsteins, a great, great loss to the internet, or at least to Facebook, is happening as we speak. And the Elvis, the internet Elvis, the Facebook Elvis that is Pater Edmund Wallstein has left the building. My friend Tomasz Wallstein, who is now Pater Edmund Wallstein, a Cistercian monk at Heiligenkreuz. I have the hardest time saying Heiligenkreuz, Holy Cross. I can't remember what is the name. It's not Treiskirchen. It's just outside of Vienna, near Trumau, where the ITI is. the International Theological Institute. Anyway, he's in a monastery over there running around Vienna. I've talked about him several times on here. So I want to give a big fat shout out, a mournful Facebook will not be the same without you shout out to Pater Edmund Wallstein, and a nice shout out to all of the members of the Never Ending Thread on Facebook, which it looks like we're going to get a Slack going. I'm going to get the experience Slack. I've never been on Slack before. Everybody's doing this Slack thing, evidently. So we're starting a Slack so that we can keep Edmund in the loop. But I guess it doesn't really mean me, but Pater Edmund, and Pater Edmund is going to continue doing his blog, which I think is Sacrosuchensis. Is that how you Sacrosuchensis? I'll have to go look it up. Anyway, look up Pater Edmund Wallstein blog. You'll probably find it. I'll try to find a link. Pretty highbrow philosophical stuff, but what a great voice for Catholicism. One of the few very, very intelligent, very conservative, but very intelligent and very open-minded, very wonder-driven voices in the Catholic Facebook world. Speaking of Catholics in a media world, man, the purge continues, and evidently National Catholic Register has purged, fired, let go our semi-owned Simca Fisher. So I want to talk about this a little bit. So first, Mark Shea got sacked by National Catholic Register, and now Simca Fisher, who is his co-host on Connecting the Dots here one day a week, I believe, on Breadbox Media, has been sacked as well. I hope they're doing a show today. And I can't wait to have heard it. I guess by the time you hear this, it will have already happened. But because I'm not recording live today. So I can't wait to see what happens. But, you know, I'm going to be careful about how much I want to say about this. But, okay, so the official statements around and kind of the thing, the justification floating around Simca in part and around Mark is that they kind of had a certain coarseness outside of their writing on National Catholic Register. Simca in particular evidently made the mistake of making semi-veiled dirty jokes a couple of times in political commentary. Oh, heaven forbid. I am so tired of the wholesale equation of Catholic media culture and this weird little sanitize for your protection kind of, you know, getting everyone in lockstep culture that is the Catholic media world. It's like no one's allowed to be human. And it's funny, just for the record, I have a lot of friends that are really big Catholic names. Okay. And I've hung out with some big Catholic names. Some I've interviewed and you've seen on here, some not. Hey, hint, they're all really human. They're all normal, not humorless, interesting, broken, striving, longing, normal, get pissed off, don't get pissed off, forgive people, you know, say things they're normal people. Okay. And this idea that, you know, we have to create this weird media culture, we have to purge everyone that's not sanitized, and purge all media that's not sanitized, purge all stories that aren't easily completely understood on the first pass, that to make everything explicit like some kind of moral fable, or to keep everybody on their, you know, it's kind of like there's a, you know, not Lenny Bruce, the other famous George Carlin has that famous bit about, was it like the seven dirty words you can't say, You know, but in the Catholic world, we have like, we have 35 dirty words you can't say, and we have 17,000, you know, 200 topics you're not allowed to address or something. And it's interesting because there's like this tiny minority of people that are scandalized or offended by that, and a tiny, even smaller, tiny minority of people that are once footing the bill for that sanitized kind of world. Well, I'm part of Breadbox Media. I try to be a fairly faithful, open human being. I try to serve God. I'm trying to follow God. I'm trying to be a decent human being in this world. I'm trying to love God and love my neighbor and trying to be a decent son of the Roman Catholic Church. But you know what? I'm human. I'm superhuman. And I've been committed to on this show, and I will continue to be committed to ripping my heart out, sewing it on my sleeve, and letting you see it. Okay? And I think that in the long run, that is more real. That is more realistic. And in the end, it's going to get us more where we want to go, which is all of us getting, you know, closer over to a relationship with God and moving into holiness. You know, it's funny. It's like, we have these phrases, you know. It's like, oh, would you let the kids see it? Well, I griped about this yesterday. No, there's things in the Bible I wouldn't want my kids to see. Reality is for grown-ups to a great extent. And I think kids can handle more than we think they can, but I think they're forced to handle too much in this world at the moment. But there are things that are appropriate for human beings to talk about that is probably not appropriate for kids to listen to. Some of those things are perfectly appropriate for Catholics to talk about, even in media. We need to get out of the idea that the word Catholic as an adjective in front of something, whether it is a place or a show or a book, means anyone anywhere can read it and it's appropriate. That's just not the case, right? I mean, it's a... Another question. I was online in a conversation earlier, and someone mentioned that one of the people ripping on Simca and rejoicing in her sacking was saying that anytime you write something, you should pretend the Blessed Virgin Mary is looking over your shoulder and ask, "Would you write that?" Okay, I'm okay with that, but maybe holiness and humorlessness. Maybe being holy and being humorless are not the same thing. Maybe you would be shocked by what a real saint would find funny or would think is good rhetoric. It's like, I'm not saying that. Like I said about Mark yesterday, I can't say that I agree. Simca famously had a little dust up with online on Facebook with a professor of mine that is a prince among human beings and one of the absolute, was like a father to me. He's one of the best people I know on planet Earth. But I've seen Simca say a lot of stuff that I completely disagreed with. But to say that she's like some kind of voice that needs to be purged from the public church or something, it's like, oh yeah. The phrase I saw someone throw out the phrase a while ago that was Catholic ISIS. I think that if you use the word, if you're listening to this and you use the word canon law in the same tone that people use the word Sharia law, you know what? You might want to do some soul searching. I just don't think that's kind of what we're going for. Now, that being said, as I've said before, we can't fight meaningless. We can't fight false meaning with meaninglessness. I'm not promoting that we'd all just say whatever the hell we want. And we try to be, we equate ourselves with the coarseness of modern engagement. I'm not saying that, but I am saying that there's a lot wider range of human emotion and human expression than is acceptable and allowed in modern Catholic media. Anyway, rant over, show over. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. Thank you so much for coming out, and I will see you next time.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.